This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Well, good morning to you. I'm in a time zone that has me in the afternoon. And so it's a joy to be with you. And it's also a joy to be with Dr. West's class. She's been gracious to invite me again. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to your students. The topic that I was asked to present on is Latinx biblical hermeneutics. And I'm going to try to give you an overview from how I see it from my vantage point as a Latino biblical scholar in the field of Old Testament, Hebrew Bible. So the first area that I'd like to introduce you to is this, what I call a hermeneutic of empire. When we think of the Latinx experience, and when I say Latinx, that includes everyone here in the Western Hemisphere that has a Spanish surname or a Spanish ancestor of some sort, who lives somewhere in the Americas. And so the first hermeneutic that I'd like to present to you is this, the idea of a hermeneutic of empire as part of Latinx biblical hermeneutics. And when you think of this part of the world and the notion of empire, you really have to start with the Spanish Empire during the 16th century. Starting with Christopher Columbus, of course, but more specifically with Hernan Cortes and the conquest of the Aztec Empire in the 16th century. This is a map that dates from the 18th century, but it gives you a sense of where the Spanish had reached into North America, colonizing most of what you see as the southern parts of the United States, Mexico, Central America. Not on this map are the Philippines. They also had expanded into the Philippines. But this is a crucial moment in the Latinx experience. You'll find that those who are reading the Bible as biblical scholars or as people of faith, this is, I think, a very crucial moment. It's a starting point. It's that moment when the European mindset and experience merged with the indigenous experience. These are some images that I was able to gather from UT Benson Library. They have a wonderful exhibit online that you could go to and see more about New Spain, which is the name that the Spanish gave to this newly conquered territory in the Western Hemisphere. This is a well-preserved indigenous codex where you have some of the earliest images of the Nahuatl Aztec population meeting with Hernan Cortes, who's sitting there on the throne there in the center. And so you get a sense, just a bit of the imagery of these two cultures coming together, the indigenous population and the European Spanish colonizers, conquistadores, as they are referred to in Spanish. With their invasion and colonization of the New World, they brought Christianity to the indigenous populations. That was one instrument of empire to conquer and subjugate the indigenous population. So quickly, the Franciscan friars and Augustinian missionaries were also accompanying the conquistadores to conquer, spiritually conquer the indigenous populations, also provide theological sort of ecclesial provisions and support for the Spanish colonizers. And here you could see this illustration of a friar preaching to noble Aztec men, preaching the gospel to them. So this is where you could see early readings of the Christian tradition, Christian scriptures, and interpreting them to this newly conquered population, indigenous population. This is a map of Coatepec. It's just outside of Mexico City, southern Mexico, near Oaxaca. And this was a map that dates to the 16th century. It was done by an indigenous scribe, but you could see already how the landscape had changed, and just in terms of the architecture that was now being erected as a result of colonization and the Spanish conquest. And there you could see these various villages that are already emerging, centered around churches. So Christianity was showing up in the geography. As part of this spiritual conquest, the Spanish brought with them in the 16th century the printing press. And so they started to print theological books, commentaries, grammars, to help with the spiritual conquest. And so some of the earliest books that were printed in the New World were done so about 100 years prior to the first books that appeared in the British colonies. And so this is one of those early texts that was printed in the shop of Juan Kronberger. He owned the printing press and sent his primary employee printer, Juan Pablos, to the New World to begin the printing press industry in New Spain. So this is some early images. These are some images of some of the early incunabula or first printed books in the New World. You could see in a lot of these early texts, readings of scripture, you find that scripture, theology are being translated into some of the local dialects, indigenous dialects. There are several dialects in the region. And Franciscans, they had to go and live with these indigenous populations, and they would essentially learn the language and, using Roman script, would write them down and create these grammar books. But you could see some of the illustrations that were also important in teaching about Christianity that come with these books. They were printed in the books. And here's an example of Jesus, an image of Christ in the temple. And me being a biblical Hebrew Bible scholar, I found it interesting, this early printing of Hebrew in this text. You could see the tetragrammaton there right above Jesus in this woodcut. So this is into the still the 16th century. You could see in other examples of these early printed books, other imagery where there's theology, there's scripture, not just in the words themselves, the content, the literary content, but also even in the printing techniques. If you could look at this capital letter that was used as to open up the first chapter in this theological treatise, I'm pose the question to you, what do you think the scene is about? I don't know if you can make it out there on the screen, but what's biblical scene is being portrayed here in this small woodcut illustration? Anyone like to respond? Well, below you could see the name Jacob. You could see that the figure here in the middle has his hands crossed, and he has his hands over the heads of two individuals here, two young men bowing down right before his bed, right at his bedside. Well, if you remember the story of Jacob blessing Manasseh and Ephraim in Genesis chapter 48. So reading scripture not only happened in text form, but even the printers themselves were reading scripture and using a particular interpretive lens in the rendering of this woodcut. It's a fascinating story about this particular printer, Pedro Ocharte, who was later tried by the Holy Office of the Inquisition for conveying Lutheran ideas through these woodcuts. And there's a very, very famous case of that entire proceedings and all that went into their investigation of his heresy. He was later released from the inquisitorial prison and allowed to print again. But there was a small moment where his life was really at stake. You could discover more of these books on the website Primeros Libros de las Americas. I was fortunate to be a part of this project early on when it started in around 2007 and 8. I worked as a curator and archivist at Texas A&M University Cushing Memorial Library. And so a lot of the digitizations of these books were done by my hand. And so I was fortunate to be a part of this wonderful project, and you could access it online. It's free. Well, with the spiritual conquest and the Spanish colonizing the indigenous population, they also established the an office for the Inquisition, the Holy Office of the Inquisition. So you could still see remnants of that office there in near the Zocalo in Mexico City. This is one of the buildings that they had as a headquarters and as also a prison. There you could find at the very top on the facade the image that is used to identify the Holy Office of the Inquisition in the New World. And they printed also edicts, what they call edicts of faith, that would be sent out broadly to various churches, giving instructions to these parishes about certain kinds of heresies to look out for, and particular books that needed to be confiscated. This is the local religious police, and the Franciscans were usually deputized to manage the mission of the Holy Office of the Inquisition in the outskirts, those parts of the New Spain that were in remote areas. And so there, one of the issues that they had to confront were exiled Jews who were Sephardic Jews primarily, who were leaving the Iberian Peninsula through the colonizing networks, the imperial networks that were being established throughout the New World, and found themselves able to find refuge in the New World under certain different sorts of disguises. They weren't able to practice Judaism in public during the 16th century because of the edict of Ferdinand and Isabella, the edict of expulsion in 1482. They had to convert or leave Spain. So a lot of Jews went underground and disguised themselves, took up, genealogies that were often fabricated in order to avoid detection by the Holy Office of the Inquisition. And so some did make it to the New World. And this is a famous case of the Carvajal family, who were captured. This was a conquistador, Spanish Portuguese conquistador, who came during the 16th century, late 16th century, colonized what is most of now South Texas and Northern Mexico, founded the city of Monterrey, but was detected as a practicer of Judaism. And so his family were arrested and they were tried, and certain members of his family were burned at the stake there in Mexico City. There was one nephew who was able to escape detection. He didn't, he was able to avoid being burned, recanted, and was assigned to this library to work as an assistant at this institution. This was this is actually the first theological school in the New World, located near Mexico City, the Colegio de Santa Cruz in Tlatelolco, Mexico. And this would have not only educated Europeans coming to train and be a part of the spiritual conquest, but also noble Aztecs. And here he had access to all sorts of books, not just books that were printed in the New World, but books that were brought over from Europe. He had access to Greek, Hebrew, Jewish texts, and developed quite a knowledge of Judaism while working in this library in the late 16th century. So he wrote a book that was later confiscated after he was released from the library he went back into the public to live and began practicing his Judaism in secret again, and wrote this black book that now has been digitized, and you can find it at the Princeton University website. They have it fully digitized. It was admitted as part of the evidence during his trial in the 16th century. After the Mexican Revolution, it was stolen from the National Archive and had been lost for several decades, and later resurfaced in 2017, I believe, is when it resurfaced and was put on display at a museum in New York City and was digitized. And now we have access to one of the earliest manuscripts done by a Spanish Jew living in the New World. And you can find in this book readings of Maimonides, his interpretation of the Decalogue, the Psalms. He also had, he wrote the Shema and certain Jewish prayers and liturgy for the Jewish calendar. So this history is also what informs contemporary Latinx biblical hermeneutics. And you could find some of these, attention to this period in works like this one by my colleague Jacqueline Hidalgo, who's at Williams College, wrote a book on Revelation in Atzatlan Scriptures, Utopias, and the Chicano Movement, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2016. So this is certainly an area that Latino and Latinx scholars do attend to in their biblical scholarship, because it's such a formative experience for Latinx people, the Spanish conquest. This is another example. This is a book that was published by my former colleague, David Arturo Sanchez, New Testament scholar, and who also attends to the Spanish conquests, the Spanish empires. It's one of those primary topics for reading the Book of Revelation. So the next hermeneutic that I find crucial to Latinx biblical hermeneutics is this hermeneutic of migration. So first I talked about hermeneutic of empire. Here we have a hermeneutic of migration. And this is a very useful resource that could help you get a sense of how crucial migration has been for various Latinx populations in this part of the world. And so I'm going to try to revert to it here. Let's see. Bear with me just for a moment. I'm going to switch over to my browser. And this is a resource that is that comes out of the University of Washington. And I find it very helpful to get a sense of the population growth from the 19th century, the Latinx population growth from the 19th century to 2017. And it sort of gives you this animation here that you could see the Latinx American population from decade to decade, starting with 1850, mm-hmm. and how it's growing. Mm-hmm. And sort of jump here to the 20th century And it's divided into two types of populations. You have the those who were born and the those who migrated. So this is a, you can see here in 2017, just a bit of how the population, the Latinx populations are growing, particularly in the US Southwest and in the Northeast. You could choose, you know, any particular nationality. So this is a helpful resource. This is another one, part of it. You could see how it moves from 1960s to the current day, and it's dividing it between the US born and the non-US born. But you could see how in the abroad is growing here in Texas, starting from the 1960s up to the 1990s. So migration is a very important part of the Latinx experience. And so it has become, it has informed Latinx biblical hermeneutics. And you could see here, if I can go back to my PowerPoint. You could see that with just the current pressed footage of migration, right? That talking about something that has just happened within the past 10 years. This has always happened since the formation of the U.S.-Mexico border. And so migration from Latin America is a lived experience, an everyday experience, it's a historical experience. So this is an important social reality that biblical scholars and their interpretive lenses try to attend to. This is a book that I think exemplifies this attention to migration, written by my colleague, Daniel Carroll Rodas. He's a Hebrew Bible scholar from Wheaton College, wrote this book that I would recommend if you want further readings on the topic, Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Bible, the Church and the Bible. That was published by Baker Academic Press, 2008. And my book, Voices of Marginality, Exile and Return in 2 Isaiah 40 to 55 and the Mexican Immigrant Experience. That's what's published by Peter Lang. There is also a very helpful video that I would also would like to put on your radar that you could find available for free on YouTube. It's Harvest of Empire. And I'm just going to play a small clip here. Hopefully you're able to hear the audio.
Taken over today by people who don't belong here. America's illegal aliens are becoming ever bolder. March through our streets and demand your rights. Excuse me, you have no rights here. This could all turn very violent as Americans become fed up with the failure of their government to address the most pressing domestic issue of our time. Thank you.
reality is that America is changing. By the end of this century, a majority of the people living in the United States will trace their origins not to Europe, but to Latin America. That's an enormous transformation in the actual composition of the nation. And unless we all understand how that happened, we will not be able to deal with the inevitable conflicts that come from ignorance between racial and ethnic groups in the America of the 21st century. As a journalist, since I've covered Latino communities across the country now for more than 30 years, and interviewed its leaders and had a sense of how those communities had been built, I felt that I should at least try to chronicle the story, because the reality is that there's a reason why there are so many Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Salvadorans in the United States, because really the major migrations come precisely from those countries that the United States once dominated and even occupied. They never teach us in school that the huge Latino presence here is a direct result of our own government's actions in Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central America over many decades. Actions that forced millions from that region to leave their homeland and journey north. My father was born in Puerto Rico, in a family that was thrust into deep poverty.
All right, well, I'm going to stop there just to give you a little taste of that documentary. Highly recommend it. And again, you could find it for free online. It's in its entirety on YouTube. And I could send you the link in the chat. The last component that I want to share with you about, well, here's another text, I'm sorry, that I also like to present to you that was just recently published in 2018. And my colleague Efrain Agosto and Jacqueline Hidalgo co-edited this book, Latinx's The Bible and Migration. And that was published by Palgrave Macmillan. So the last hermeneutic that I want to introduce to you, and of course, I'm not exhausting all there is to Latinx biblical hermeneutics. There's so many different other parts of this discourse that it would take probably a month for us to cover. What I'm trying to do is give you some high points, those points that have generated a lot of attention from biblical scholars, Latinx biblical scholars. And so the last one would be a hermeneutic of borderlands that I also see as crucial to Latinx biblical hermeneutics. And when we think of the border between the US and Mexico, this is something that came into being later in the region. But prior to that current border that we have, in the southern border, much of the what was part of the Republic of Mexico, you could see how far that border went well into what is Washington State and even into Canada. So when we think about borders or borderlands in the region, there are different parts to that story that I think are important to understand. And biblical scholars who attend to the borderlands are also looking at this history going back to Spain and to the Republic of Mexico, and then when the U.S. annexed a large part of the Republic of Mexico, forming in 1842 the border between Texas and Mexico, and then later as it moved further west, establishing the what is now the 2,000 mile border between the U.S. And Mexico. So when we think of the border or borderlands from a Latinx perspective, of course, it is a place of trauma. It is a place of pain, right? It comes about from a war between Mexico and the U.S. It's also a part of a colonizing impulse, a colonizing effort. So there's that issue that is of concern when biblical scholars are attending to this social context of borderlands. Gloria Anzaldúa's famous work, Frontera, refers to the border as an open wound. And so this is certainly something that you find attended to in the literature, Latinx scholars attending to that wound, that pain, that trauma, that goes back to the early, you know, the 19th century. You could see with the lynchings of Mexicans, the massacres that were done in South Texas by the Texas Rangers. Here I'm thinking of the Porvenir massacre in the 20th century that just recently has now been marked historically with a historical marker that you can go to and read about that massacre in South Texas. There's the contemporary wound that we find on the border. And I'm sure you remember this haunting image of Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez died with his 23-month-old daughter, Valeria. They drowned there in the Rio Grande. And just recently now with the 30,000 Haitians who find themselves camping out near the international border, international bridge there near Del Rio, Texas. And you probably saw this haunting image. So these are concerns that biblical scholars, Latinx biblical scholars, will often incorporate in their reading of scripture. And just recently, within the past 6 years, I started to engage the borderlands more directly, especially with the asylum seekers that have been coming to Texas from Central America. And they're you know, having come in large groups and seeking asylum, being taken to detention facilities and then dropped off at bus stations in places like McAllen, San Antonio, and Brownsville. And so I've been working with a group of activists, clergy, seminarians, and we've been going to these bus stations to sit with asylum seekers and just offer our presence of welcome. And we also offer the children who are waiting for their buses art materials for them to draw or to color while they pass the time waiting for their buses. And so this has been my engagement as a biblical scholar with the borderlands, and having this project, this art project, evolve over the years. Some of the art that the artists have done, we've been fortunate to receive as gifts. The children will sometimes give us their doodles or their artwork as a token of appreciation for just being there. And so here you could see some of the artists drawing their homes, their pets, their journeys. And having studied exile and having studied migration in scripture, I've found there's to be a connection, a really interesting connection between those stories in the Bible and the migratory experiences that these asylum seekers express in their art. Here are some art pieces that have been gifted to us from some of the children, and you could get a sense of what they think about when they're drawing these pieces. Here, this is a drawing of Jefferson's hometown with a smiley sun and a smiley moon, and you have his favorite pet there near his house, a garden. This is another drawing that was gifted to us, done by a 7-year-old who was drawing her journey to the Texas-Mexico border. And it was very fascinating what she did. She started off with the river and the river walk, the river rocks there in the riverbed. You could see the little circles that she drew there. And then she drew the road that she took. You could see it with the large up and down strokes, and then the car and the bus that they took. And then she drew the little makeshift raft that her and her mother took to cross over the river. And I asked her if there was somebody there who said goodbye to them when they crossed over. And she said her aunt was there. And so she drew her aunt there on the left side. And I asked her if there was anyone else. And she didn't say anything, but just proceeded to pull off her rosary and took the cross and put it on the top of the river and drew the image of the cross, signifying that Jesus was there with them while they were crossing. There are some other drawings that we've been gifted. Even some of the parents participate, and they'll give us drawings of their journey experience. This one was done by a mother, 36-year-old mother from Central America, talking about her journey from El Salvador all the way to the Texas-Mexico border. And you find these prayers sometimes in these drawings where they talk about their faith in God. And that expression of faith resonates with biblical stories that you have in places like Genesis, where Abram was called by God. So there's a level of faith to migrate. And so that's very present in a lot of the art that we've received. These are some images of the artists actually doing the art. This one here, done by an artist from Guatemala, and her name was Genesis. And so she drew the detention facility, the immigration officials and their vehicles, the prison trucks that they use to apprehend the asylum seekers. Then she drew the little makeshift raft that they used to cross the river. And I asked her if there was anyone else with her, and she proceeded to draw this figure there on the top right corner near the sun, and she said God was with them. So there's a really interesting narrative of faith in these drawings. And this is another one that she did of her family together back in their house in Central America, where she drew all of the toys that she used to play with in her own room and all of the various places where her and her brother would play. And so we've developed a website where we are trying to put all of this art on display at this website, Arte de Lágrimas. And what I'll do is I'm going to share this last resource with you, and then I could open it up for discussion. Let's see here. So this is a website that I have been able to develop, and it just showcases the work that we're doing with the art. We have been doing exhibits at churches and also seminaries. We've done a couple at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary, McCormick Theological Seminary, Union Theological Seminary in New York. So this is a website. You'll also find some podcasts that offer interviews with various scholars about teaching Borderlands. So that may be of interest. And this book I just recently published with Routledge, Resacralizing the Other at the U.S.-Mexico Border, a Borderland Hermeneutic. So this is an overview, not a comprehensive overview of Latinx biblical hermeneutics, but what I've tried to map for you are social domains that have generated a lot of attention from Latinx biblical scholars. And that attention to these social dimensions of empire, migration, and borderlands occurs because there's personal experience. There's a personal, intimate experience with those realities. And so that's much of what goes into Latinx biblical hermeneutics, is to speak about the injustices, about the trauma, about the migration, those realities that are part of the communities, different nationalities from Latin America, their experiences. And this, there's a lot of overlap that we have with each other.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.